We've started with integration. And of course, when you're integrating yourself, you're taking full responsibility for yourself as a moral agent. And when you practice positive emotion, you're shaping karma in a skillful direction. Having taken possession of your moral agency, you're using it in a skillful direction. And as a consequence of that work, you emerge in a new way. There's a sense of a deeper energy or force, which I yesterday dared to speak of as an erotic force, a mythic force, the force that through the green fuse drives the flower, as you Dylan Thomas fans know. Even a suprapersonal force, something ultimate in you expressing itself through you, a spirit of delight, whatever we like to call it. And spiritual receptivity, or better, I think, dhammic responsiveness, is first of all simply a responsiveness to what gives delight, where your heart lies, of something of some greater value, and then becomes a clearer and clearer response to real moral and aesthetic quality, and finally becomes a responsiveness to truth, to Dhamma itself. But even the development of integration, even the development of positive emotion, even the development of spiritual receptivity or dhammic responsiveness is not enough. Something still gets in the way. We've refined those energies, we've directed them, we've begun to open up to deeper forces within us, but something prevents that from coming to fruition. It sort of flowers and then dies again. You can experience this sometimes in retreat or in a very, very positive situation. You can feel yourself beginning to fly high, and you can really, for a little while, genuinely feel something beyond yourself coming through you. But you fall back. You collapse back, you might say, almost without your knowing it. Or that begins to emerge in you, and your mind grabs hold of it and kills it. You make it into a possession which destroys it. You respond, you fall back into old patterns. Karma has brought you, therefore, as far as you can go. Through the development of karma, you can get some sense of this deeper force unfolding within you, but you cannot completely let go into it. You cannot identify yourself fully with it. You cannot get out of the way and let it unfold. So what is it that prevents it from fully emerging, prevents that erotic force, that force of deep attraction to the highest value? What is it that prevents it carrying you away? Why do you fail to be fully transported? You know it on a quite ordinary level, don't you? You get really inspired on a retreat, and you can see how the whole of the rest of your life needs to go. Yes, I am thinking of some people in the room. But somehow afterwards, you can't even remember what the inspiration was, and something else carries you away. Why? What is it in essence, in fundament? Even at quite high levels of spiritual life and practice, this still goes on, apparently. So what is it that holds you back? What is it that really dams up, turns back the flood of that force, that stream of Dhamma? Well, the Buddha says that it is Atman. It's clinging to Atman, clinging, in a brief and not very adequate English phrase, to self, clinging to self-identity. It's that prevents the full flood of the Dhamma unfolding within us or rushing through us, carrying us along. So what does this really mean? Let's just try a very brief experiment. It's bound to not be fully successful because I'm not setting it up in the way that it needs to be set up. We need to have really a powerful meditation retreat. But just to get clear, at least conceptually, with a little bit of experiential reference, let's just try something right now. So you're here, your ears are open, and I don't know whether you can hear it, but there's a faint hum in the background, which I presume is the... Well, maybe it doesn't matter what it is. Let's not even investigate what it is. There's a faint hum in the background. So you can, yeah, you can hear that hum. And interestingly, you know, I immediately started to tell you what I thought it was. In other words, I try to fit it into a conceptual structure. But let's just leave it as a faint hum. And I could ask you, well, who is listening to that hum? Who is hearing that hum? And really, what you're experiencing is simply humming. You're not experiencing a something which is making it happen. You don't experience that. And you don't experience directly somebody who's hearing it. There's just a humming. And maybe even, you know, as I'm sort of directing your attention, you're able to get a little glimpse of that. You can just sort of open up to the, as it were, pure hum without putting too much of a framework on it and starting to conceptualize it and so forth. There's just a humming. But if we're honest about it, and really we could spend a whole session just investigating this moment, if we're honest about it, we can see the way in which very quickly we start to impose upon that pure experience, the pure experience of sound, a something which is causing the sound. You know, I completely spontaneously just started to tell you what the sound was coming from, because that's natural to one, to try to identify something that's the source of the sound. But much more tacitly, we're thinking of, I am listening to the sound. We're bringing into the experiencing moment, we're importing into it a real I which is hearing it. Actually, if we took the trouble to investigate this moment, we'd find that you can't actually find either in that sound the source of the sound. We can only impute it. We can only think it in. You know, we can think the heating system or whatever, but we're not actually experiencing that. We're experiencing just a humming. And much more unconsciously, much less clearly differentiatedly, we assume a somebody listening to it. Well, not to put too fine a point upon it, me listening to it. We automatically add that into the moment of experience. And sort of fair enough in a kind of way. We read our experience in terms of somebody who's having the experience, I, and something that is really external to us, that exists, as they say, from its own side, independent of the experiencing moment. We just assume that. It's sort of built in to the structure of our experience, or our way of approaching our experience. Happens automatically. But when we start to investigate, even perhaps you got a little glimpse of it in that little, you know, very inadequate experiment that I did, you can begin to get a sense that there isn't anything that you can actually know that stands outside, or anything that you can actually know that has the experience. They're imputed, they're thought in. That's what the Buddha says. They're not part of experience. Well, they are part of experience, but they're part of experience as mental constructions, not as direct experiences. Of course, you can sort of directly experience the mental construction, but as a mental construction, it is not what it appears to be. It doesn't refer to what it seems to refer to. And it's constructed. It's constructed on the basis of the way in which experience naturally unfolds. Experience naturally unfolds with what we could call an inward perceiving dimension. There's a range of elements of our experience which are to do with receiving, let's say, perceiving. Very difficult to use language that doesn't already presuppose the very thing that we're trying to investigate. But it also comes pre-packaged, so to speak, with an outward perceived aspect or part. In Yogacara, this is called darshanabhaga, the seeing part, and nimittabhaga, the perceived or object part. Let's call it object, mental object part. So that's part of the given. Buddha's experienced that too. Experience simply comes like that because of the perceptual mechanisms that we've got. We've got eyes, brains that deal with the data of our experience, and they assemble it, present it to us, represent it to us in terms of an inward perceiving and an outward perceived aspect. So far, so real. That's the way it appears. It's, as it were, a real appearance. The whole of our experience, of course, is a representation. Vide Schopenhauer, etc. We don't actually experience things external to us. The representations in our mind are constructions on the basis of we know not what. We won't go too far into the philosophy of that. But yes, the representation is a representation which has this inward perceiving and outward perceived aspect. But what the Buddha says is that we then read that experience in terms of a real perceiver who has the perceptions standing independent of the perceiving moment. And a real perceived, a real world, if you like, a real object that stands outside the perceiving moment and that is the object of that perceiving moment. So we impute, we read in to our experience a real internal perceiver and a real external perceived. And we do that completely automatically. And we've been doing it all our lives. Everybody else is doing it. Our whole world is constructed on that basis. All human interchange is based on that. It's a complete given. And more so as we enter a more and more materialist interpretation of the world, which is less and less malleable, less and less fluid. And it's okay as far as it goes. It's quite useful. It means you get your breakfast and get on retreat and even practice the Dhamma. Without it, it would be very difficult to practice the Dhamma because you wouldn't know who was going to practice the precepts, if you see what I mean. So it's a sort of mental construction that from the point of view of the practice of the Dhamma is really essential. You know, animals don't practice the Dhamma because they don't do very much. They don't differentiate internal perceiver and external perceived. They do to some degree, but not very much. So this emerges out of the mechanism of perception, the mano-niyama processes. Onto that mechanism of perception, we impute, or into that mechanism of perception, that process of perception, we impute a real I, a stable, fixed, internal, but independent, and even, you could say, ultimately unchanging. And we read in a real world out there that is independent of the perceiving moment. And as I say, it works to quite a high degree. It enables the most sophisticated social constructions. It enables atom bombs and, I was going to say, time machines for some reason. It hasn't done that yet. But, you know, very, very complex technical achievements and very highly sophisticated interpretations of the world. Large Hadron Colliders and all that sort of thing. And the discovery of Higgs bosons and so on and so forth. All of that emerges out of our capacity to make a world that is so concretized, externalized. We can then investigate it. It enables us to achieve so much because identifying I, we can project ourselves into the future. We can have a plan, have a project. we can learn from the past. We can think about where we've come from and learn from what we've done. It enables the whole of human society. It lifts us above the animal realm. But essentially, the Buddha says this extra bit that we add into our experience is simply mentally constructed. It doesn't refer to anything outside the mind and the processes of the mind. It is simply something we've read in, we've constructed, we've created. We've created it without knowing we create it, and we keep it in being without knowing we keep it in being. And we reinforce it in each other, and our whole culture reinforces it in us. But it exists only in our minds. But when we say mind, we usually then start thinking intellect, as it were. We start thinking concepts and brain power. It's not just a thought. These imputations, even though imputation, you know, comes from a Latin root meaning to think, it's not thought in that putari, for those who remember their Latin. It's not thought in the narrow sense of concepts, the manipulation of concepts. It's, if you like, an emotio-cognitive complex. It's a charged thought, a highly charged thought. In fact, it's stronger on charge than on thought, in reality. You know, you try taking away from me something that's precious to me. You'll find out whether it's mainly a thought, as my fist hits your nose. It's a thought we'll die for, if you like. Literally, people will die for it. They'll fight and die for it. In Sanskrit, this work worked out especially in Yogacara, which I think is the Buddhist school that has the sharpest understanding of all this, in my own opinion. The imputed self is known as the grahaka. Graha is a verb meaning to grasp. So grahaka is grasper. If you put ka on the end, it's a, if you see what I mean, E-R. So it's the one who grasps, and the external element, the what appears to be a real external, is the grahya, the grasped. So in we sometimes use the word subject and object, but I think it's very bad usage because it blurs a boundary between inward perceiving and this extra bit, if you see what I mean, for the philosophically inclined. So I think we're best to use something like these Sanskrit terms, grahaka and grahya, or grasper and grasped. We impute into our experience a real grasper who we then defend. It's strongly attached to this grasper. This grasper is attachment, and it's attachment to what appears to be a really existent external. Very deeply imbued in us, below the level of our consciousness. That's a lot of the problem for us. It's kind of automatic. It's so deeply embedded in us. In fact, according to the Yogacara, it's sahati. In other words, it's born with us, or innate. We come in already with that propensity to bifurcate, or rather impute into that polarized experience, a real grasper and a real grasped. That tendency is there right from the start. And if you've had the, privilege, sometimes curse, of bringing up a small child, you'll see that already present from quite an early age. You'll see it, and you'll see it gradually unfolding, and it will be your job as a parent, well, in a way, to bring that to full flowering so that they can become a real moral agent. But it comes with us, and this is part of the problem. I think a lot of the problem in discussing all this is that, because, you know, I've given you a quite neat conceptual expression of it all, and perhaps you've followed me. And because you followed me, perhaps you think you've understood. You haven't. And even I, in explaining it to you, haven't a clue what I'm talking about. Intellectual gymnastics, though, I've done so brilliantly on the high wire of this lecture. But it's actually under the surface. It's sort of built in. And it's so deeply built in that it's really difficult to get hold of. It's a bit like the Loch Ness Monster. You know, whenever you go and look at Loch Ness, you never see the monster, although you always hear stories about it. And the trick is you've got to catch it poking its head above the water. Well, when does the monster, when does Nessie, the Nessie of Grasper and Grasp, when does that appear? It's most likely to appear when you're provoked. I remember a dramatic moment here at Padmaloka. It didn't take place on the tartan carpet. Actually, part of it did take place on the tartan carpet. But it took place in the pantry, with that room next to the kitchen, where the storage room is, it, as it were. And one day I heard an enormous commotion in there. And I rushed in, and I, you know, because it was obviously something very, very wrong going on. And I found one community member with a carving knife sticking it actually into another. I mean, not breaking the skin, but sticking it in. I don't know whether this is a regular practice at Padmaloka. This was many, many years ago, I hasten to say. You know, I shouted the name of the person, which I'm not going to shout now, and he dropped his knife and ran. So I went up to see Bante a little bit later on that red tartan carpet. And I said to Bante, you know, isn't this dreadful? You know, this chap, you know, really bad what he's done and so forth and so on. So I was really quite deeply shocked. And Bante, it's one of those moments when, you know, Bante suddenly gets out of his cage. And he just turned to me and he said, don't think you're not capable of that. He said, you know, push anybody far enough and that's there in them. Maybe not with a carving knife, he didn't say this, but what I took him to mean is that when the ego, when this self-clinging is sufficiently threatened, you don't know what you're going to do. And you may do something that's really quite surprising in all sorts of possible directions. So it's often we live this nice, polite, friendly life, which is very good. Please carry on living a nice, friendly, polite life. It's better than carving knives at dawn. Actually, it was middle of the afternoon, but that's another question. But under the surface, this structure of self-clinging and of a grasper and grasped is there. And when it's pushed too far, it shows itself. And it's often not a very pretty sight when it is exposed. You know, we order our lives so that there's sufficient cotton wool between us so that this doesn't come out. It's only often in the most intimate situations of our lives that we're likely to really encounter it. You know, most serious violence, most murder, for instance, takes place within the home, because that's when, you know, you're pushed beyond your limit. And you know it sometimes in that sort of situation. You're just pushed beyond your limit. You don't want to, but you do. So this sort of deep self-attachment, it's characterized, according to the Yogacara again, by four aspects of Atma Klesha. Klesha is defilement or distortion, you might say. Negative emotion, that's far too weak. But right down at the level of innate, below the level of our conscious self-construction, our conscious memory and thought, usually, is characterized by attachment to self, Atma Sneha, by Atma Mana, pride in self. In other words, it's highly defended. We think we are number one. That sounds funny, but it's actually true. We think the universe should revolve around us. And if it doesn't, we will do our cunning best or our forceful best to get it to do so. So it's characterized by these strong affective conditions of attachment and pride. Attachment and pride are far too weak translations of what they are. And on the other hand, the cognitive dimensions of moha, which is ignorance, which is simply a failure to really understand the way things are, and atmadrishti, which means not just failing to understand, but thinking that you do. and reading in these false constructions of grasper and grasped. So this is very deeply embedded in the structure of our consciousness. Consciousness is bigger than that, but we found our mental life upon that, within the overall expansive experience of consciousness, if you can call consciousness experience. Yes, so that's what is generated, a deep self-attachment which motivates us all the time. It's all right, brothers, we're all doing it. And it's okay. It's going to take a long time to get beyond that, so let's try and acknowledge the fact that, you know, I think I'm number one, and I know you think you're number one. So let's try and work with that so that we can together go beyond that. It's there. That's the way it is. You know, there's a famous incident, isn't there, in the Pali Canon where Bimbisara is on the roof of his palace with his queen, Malikar. Is that Bimbisara? Or? I might have got the names wrong. But the queen sort of turns to the king and says, rather reflectively, do you know, I've been thinking there's only one thing that's really dear to me. So the king, one imagines, sort of starts to think, oh, well, here we go, declaration of love coming. And she says, yes, there's only one thing really dear to me, nothing dearer to me than me. So the king then thinks, yeah, you're right. Actually, there's no one dearer to me than me. And Bhante's comment on this was this is sort of a healthy recognition. And from that healthy recognition, well, first of all, you can pursue your own best interests by acting upon karma, and you can begin to enter into a more empathic relationship with others. But, yeah, we've all got it. And we, on that basis, we're then attached to what we think are real, solid, dependable people, things, situations, even arsenal. We think we can really depend upon these things. You're probably not that stupid. But we grab things which we think somehow are structured into the nature of things, and we form our idea of happiness upon them. And what is the sum of all this? Dukkha. We're constantly doomed to pain. Because it isn't the way things are. So it constantly bumps up against reality. Things fail. Things break. Things go away. She falls in love with somebody else, etc., etc. And you yourself are not always loved. You're not always successful. You're not always the hero. So this self-attachment and attachment to other is doomed. It's inevitable. As long as we remain convinced that there is a real I, independent of the perceiving moment, that perceives, and a real object that exists independent of the perceiving moment, that is perceived, as long as we do that, we're going to again and again and again suffer. And even more than that, we're going to suffer because we're not experiencing the full potential, the full implication of our awareness. Our awareness cannot flower. It's as if we're confining a lion in a cage so that it cannot have its full range. We're cramping as something that is vast as the sky in a pint pot. And the very experience of that cramping is pain, is dukkha. So it prevents the flow of those Dhamma Niyama processes. It prevents the flow of that erotic power, erotic force that I tried to evoke yesterday. That force that moves through us, that moves through everything, but that isn't definable and doesn't come from anywhere, but is simply a natural upsurge of energy. It spoils beauty. It destroys friendship. It even corrupts our thought because it prevents our thought from reaching reality. It even corrupts the Dhamma because we impose upon the Dhamma our false constructions and assimilate the Dhamma to our own expectations and our own selfish interests. So, in sum, we've got to get rid of it. We've got to kill it. We've got to die spiritually. Got to die spiritually so that flow that we contacted in spiritual receptivity, that flow that we enabled to emerge in a more and more wholesome way through our integration and through our positive emotion, work on positive emotion. We've got to get out of the way that self-construction, that grasper and grasped, fixes and limits, and it prevents that flow from really achieving its full current, its full tide. It turns it back again and again and again. So we have to get rid of it. And this is what we're doing in the practice of spiritual death, under this aspect of the Dhamma life. We're working to get rid of that innate conviction that there is a real internal grasper and a real external grasped. So how do we do it? Well, the first and perhaps the most important thing is to get our views straight. And frankly, I think that this is a bigger task than we realise. We have to get them straight at the most basic level. We have to really understand the Buddhist perspective on reality. This, I guess, is the subject, I think you still do it, of the Transcendental Principle Retreat, which was actually the foundation of this whole new approach to the ordination process. When we study the survey, we're studying the Buddha's most basic conception of the way things really are. And you need to get that very clear. You need to understand what Pratitya-samuppada means, just in conceptual terms, first of all. You need to understand what anityata means. You need to understand anatman. You need to understand dukkha. You need to understand what is meant by dukkha in terms of this inevitable suffering that is connected with clinging. You need to understand what shunyata means, the fact that there isn't anything fixed, and that that fixity is the opportunity for that very powerful current to achieve its full tide. You need to understand the middle way. You need to understand the two extremes of nihilism and eternalism, into which all thought falls if it is not founded upon Pratitya-samuppada. So all the thought that you're encountering around you, in the books you read, in the newspapers, in so many of the ideas that we encounter in the therapies, in the New Age philosophy, in so many areas, at the back of them all is eternalism or nihilism. Modern scientific thinking is often not philosophically acute, and it presupposes a materialist perspective. The most sophisticated go beyond that, but very, very few and far between. And so much of our modern life presupposes nihilism. Nihilism in the technical, philosophical sense, or in the Dhammic sense, of a belief that ultimately there is nothing, that it's all a kind of, you know, accidental play of atoms and molecules that has no ultimate meaning and no ultimate direction. This is probably the major affliction for most of us. And I think that probably most of us, when we really examine ourselves, are nihilists, if we're really honest, whatever our beliefs may be. So we need to get clear at the very conscious conceptual level about this basic take on the Dhamma, so that we just got it clear. We may not be, you know, able to transform a bit deeper down, but we need to get it clear at that level. Then we need to constantly challenge our own responses and assumptions and begin to be much more aware of nihilism and eternalism as they're represented in the ideas that we're encountering around us. I think that, particularly in the modern world, everybody needs a far greater sophistication of mitya drishti detection, wrong view detection. We need a sort of, you know, mitya ditti detector but not a technical one. So you're immediately alive. There's eternalism here. There's a nihilism here. This is departing from the middle way. This perspective on the Dhamma that you're getting from outside our context is riddled with eternalism. This is riddled with or underlain by nihilism. So much of the modern Buddhist scene is subtle nihilism. This is what I mentioned before. Nietzsche warned of that Western culture, with its death of God, was moving further and further into nihilism, which he described as eventuating in a kind of Western Buddhism. Of course, he misunderstood Buddhism to that extent, but he thought of it as a sort of positive nihilistic attitude. Life doesn't add up to anything, but let's have a bit of fun, a glass of wine, and be nice to each other until curtains. And that is what a lot of Buddhism is. A lot of Buddhism out there. And sometimes, I'm sorry to say, a lot of Buddhism in here. We're subtly nihilist. So we need to develop a clear conceptual understanding. It doesn't have to be sophisticated. You don't have to be able to do your Schopenhauer's and all that. But you need to be able to understand these basic teachings. Pratichasamuppada, three lakshanas, shunyata, middle way. And be able to apply them in your own experience. You need to really understand them, really be convinced by them, and be able to notice your own nihilism or eternalism. Because actually, eternalism and nihilism underlie all our unskillful actions. If you have right view, you can't act unskillfully. So all unskillful action emerges from either subtle or not so subtle eternalism or subtle or not so subtle nihilism. I won't explain that further. It demands it, but I can't now. So yes, we need to get really clear about this and be thinking accurately about the Dhamma. And not, as I say, necessarily that everybody has to become a philosophical wizard or a PhD or anything like that. But we all need to be capable of a certain basic level of conceptual understanding of these issues and be able to apply them to ourselves and to what's around us. We're all different, so some are not going to find it easy to do that in a very highly articulated way, but that doesn't matter. That's not the point. It's being able to exercise it. And yeah, make sure you've got it. It's the heart of the Dhamma. It's this that differentiates the Dhamma from everything else. Everything else is a very hot topic in India because so much of Mahayana Buddhism and especially Vajrayana Buddhism just looks like Hinduism because it uses all the same iconography. And actually, we can't use it in India for that very reason. But what's the difference between, you know, a bodhisattva sitting on a lotus with arms and heads and all the rest of it and, you know, Sarasvati or one of the Hindu gods? Indeed, what's the difference between the Buddhist Sarasvati and the Hindu Sarasvati? Because the same gods and goddesses are found in both religions. The difference is shunyata. The difference is that Buddhism subjects even these divine experiences to a shunyata analysis. Not just analysis in the conceptual sense, but a shunyata experience. Even these figures are empty. And that's why in Vajrayana meditation, you always visualize against the background of the blue sky, which represents shunyata. So what really differentiates Buddhism from Christianity, from Hinduism, from Islam, all of which it shares quite a number of features, even quite a range of experience. What differentiates it from them? It's shunyata. It's anatman, it's anityata, it's pratichasamuppada. So you need to get this if you're to be a Buddhist. And if you've asked for ordination, presumably you already think you might be one. We share so much with them. You know, I found that sort of quite interesting. I noticed, I think it was the Dalai Lama, went to Montserrat, the sort of national abbey of Catalans near Barcelona. And he was talking about the similarity of their religious life. But what I found interesting, because the Dalai Lama is, of course, a diplomat, trying to get his country back, he didn't mention the difference, which is that for us, any fixed entity has to be dissolved into shunyata. And the Black Madonna at Montserrat is not dissolved into shunyata, as far as I know. Of course, there may be things they don't tell the Pope. The difference between Buddhism and other religions lies in this extraordinary clarity, even philosophical clarity, about what is really knowable with concepts, the limits of concepts. So we need to get that clear conceptually before anything. There's no point in meditating on these things unless you've got quite a high degree of clarity about them. Then you do meditate. And we've got various tools to hand, and there could potentially be more. It's not in principle restricted. It's whatever actually helps to bring you to a direct recognition of the emptiness of this imputed self, or grasper rather. We've got the six element practice. I'm not going to explain these because time doesn't permit, but we've got a practice in which you look at each of the elements as they make you up and you recognise there's nothing permanent. There's no substantial self in them. And you say to yourself, all this earth element in me, it's not me, not mine, not myself. Even with consciousness, you recognise there's nothing in consciousness that is stable, is fixed. It's just awareness. And it's not merely a reflection. It's a reflection which generates a direct experience of the emptiness of these elements of your experience. And therefore, an experience of flow, of the flow of Dhamma Niyama processes. We've got the Nidana chain practice, in which you contemplate the 24 Nidanas, or 23 rather, the cyclic and the spiral. You sort of go round them and up and so on. And we have the meditation on the six bardos, which looks at the bardos that are found in the Tibetan tradition, looks at these intermediate states, all life being one or other kind of intermediate state, and you recognise the characteristics of each, and you recognise that each flows on to the next, and so on. Very powerful practice. Or you can meditate on the Lakshanas, you can meditate on Anicca, Anatman, you can meditate on Shunyata. So you reflect on these deep Dharma teachings so that you generate from your conviction in their truth, you generate a direct experience of their truth. Do you see what I mean? There's a difference between being able to manipulate the concept successfully, like I'm doing now, and actually experiencing what those concepts are about. So you meditate in order to arrive at the direct experience of what they're talking about. You contemplate more and more deeply, and an experience is generated. You stay with that experience of openness, of shunyata. It unfolds at least for a while. You get a direct experience that there is no fixed self. First of all, it may be destructive in the sense that your experience is mainly focused on realizing that there is nothing there, if you can understand what I mean. But of course, the experience that there is nothing there in terms of a fixed self is also an experience of what is really going on. But we'll say more about that tomorrow. So you're just aware of the inward perceiving aspect and the outward perceived aspect flowing along without grasping. There's still a perceived aspect side of things, as it were. There are feelings, there's images in your brain, in your mind, as it were. You experience a mental image, and there's a sense of something beyond yourself. But you know that that doesn't refer to anything. And you're able simply to hang loosely to the inward perceiving and the outward perceived aspects whilst remaining, you could say, larger than them, to use a spatial metaphor. So that consciousness is simply there. There's simply pure awareness in which the perceived and the perceiving aspect flow, unfold naturally in accordance with pratityasamuppada, but without grasping onto them. So that is what a practice at a more sort of committed level amounts to under this heading, and that's what you'll be increasingly introduced to as you come up to ordination, and especially from ordination onwards, you're expected to be committing yourself to this element being in your daily meditation practice in a really concerted way. When you go for refuge effectively, when you're acknowledged, witnessed as going for refuge effectively, you are witnessed as committing yourself to spiritual death. That's what you are signing up to, gents. You said, I want to die spiritually, whether you know it or not. And we're going to hold you to your word, whether you knew you gave it or not. So you need to be actively applying this sort of practice in your daily meditation. But it's more than that. You need to be applying it in your life. And this you need at least to begin doing now, if you haven't already done so. In fact, you probably have. Otherwise, I don't know why on earth you're here. It's probably because you have begun to do that, that you are here. You need to be mindful of what's happening, of this real situation that we're in, and mindful of its impermanent character, which forces itself upon you from time to time when, you know, you lose, when things fail, when things break, when things aren't there, expectations are not fulfilled. When those moments unfold, use them to look at the underlying nature of things. I talked about this in connection with divorce, which is a very useful practice. I recommend you go and do it immediately. It's a joke, by the way. But you know, these moments of loss, these moments of when your attachments are challenged, are broken, those are the moments when you see the real nature of things. This is when the gap opens up. Shunyata gleams through. You see the blue infinite sky through that gap when things are not as you want them to be. So yes, you reflect on your experience as it unfolds. Use the reality of your daily experience as a basis for your reflection. We're too prone to blame, to find excuses, to try to sort out. Particularly, I know Westerners, we are born with the idea that we can solve it. I remember an American friend arriving in India, and he arrived from, you know, the airport and a day in Bombay on retreat at Baja, and he was angry. What was he angry about? He was angry about the slums in Bombay. He couldn't understand why nobody'd fixed it. Because that's what an American does. He goes out and fixes it. He just couldn't understand how that sort of mess and suffering could be allowed to go on. Why the people there themselves didn't sort it out. Of course, there's a lot more complex than that. But we're born to think everything can be fixed. That's the nature of our culture, I think, at the moment, and a highly technical culture. But it can't all be fixed. And it won't always just be as you want it to be. Computers are really good for this, aren't they? Because they never completely work. And those moments when the crash happens, stop and reflect on the nature of reality. Because you've just hit it. You've hit the nature of reality in virtual reality, which is a good clue to what's going on. I'm quite serious. Take these moments to stand back. Watch your own automatic feeling that, you know, bloody Microsoft or Apple or whatever it may be, you know, they shouldn't have made that happen. However good it is, it's going to happen. Reality is not fixable. So we spot the moments when it breaks down, we pay attention to them, and we read the lesson, we read the sermon, the preaching that's going on from those moments of breakdown, which can be really quite profound. When the breakdown is sufficiently strong, particularly in terms of personal relationships, you can even see self breaking down. You can see that you don't know who you are. You don't know how to, you know, get out of bed. Quite literally, you just don't know what sort of buttons to push to get yourself to do things. Well, I've had that experience. I don't know whether anybody else has. But you can have, you know, you don't have to be what would be called mentally ill to have that experience. I think you just have to be a decent human being. to experience that sort of challenge to your selfhood. And, well, perhaps we should think more carefully about what we call mental illness in that light. Yeah, so you gradually recognise what's going on in your immediate experience, and you try deliberately to stop identifying with mental construction. You try to allow that pure flow of what I've been calling erotic force, erotic energy, the suprapersonal, the Dhamma Niyama, you try to just get out of its way and allow it through. You let them unfold without hindrance or none that can actually prevail. Once you've broken through the first three fetters, once you've broken into the stream of the Dhamma, yes, there's still self-clinging there, but it can't prevail. It can't stop the flow. It can slow it down, so to speak. It can create eddy and turbulence, but it can't stop it. And you've still got a choice of actually promoting that flow more fully, but you can't stop it. So you need to have this aspect of work alive from the start of your spiritual life, your Dhamma life. You need to be working in this way right from the start. But you can't really get very far with it. It won't strike very deep unless you've done a lot of preliminary work. And the problem is, and I think this is the problem with what we can read on the internet and what we can get from shallow teaching, that's the problem, that our reflection can be quite compelling, but it's quite superficial. I've seen this a number of times. People think they've seen the unreality of the self. They think they've seen shunyata, but they've merely been able to understand the concepts quite sort of convincingly. But they haven't got through the construction itself. And indeed, that conceptual understanding feeds that clinging, because it becomes another attachment. So you start getting obsessed with whether you've got insight or stream entry or diddly diddly diddly. I think if you're concerned with those things, you can be pretty damn sure you haven't got it. I'd say that's axiomatic. And what's the point of being concerned with it? How can, you know, bother, you know, you can't convince anybody else. If you did convince them, they'd be convinced without really knowing. And if you don't convince them, well, what difference does it make to you? So you just leave it alone. Yes, if you're not integrated, it can very easily simply go to your concepts, your mental construction, and then that will feed your own self-attachment. Some of the stream entrants I've known have been the most monstrously egotistical people I've encountered. In fact, I'm quite off stream entry. I mean, you should be very careful that we don't approach these things too shallowly. There needs to be enough of the deeper work that, you know, could say preliminary work, but that belittles it. You know, we don't want to do preliminary work. We want to go straight to PhD level without doing our... I couldn't remember what you do nowadays. 11 plus or whatever. No. If we're not integrated, it goes to just part of us, if you see what I mean. Because our head and our heart are not together. So our head understands, but our heart is completely left out. If you've not developed your positive emotion, this sort of reflection could just depress you. I've seen people really severely upset and depressed by things like the six element practice and so forth. And a lot of people, I say, forget insight. Just get happy. Please, for all our sakes, just go and get happy. And especially for yours, but for mine too. Please just go and live a decent, happy, healthy life. Go and work physically, go for a run. You know, all the sort of very basic stuff. Just get healthy. Forget about insight and all that for the time being. That will come. But yeah, just get happy. Well, Bhante used to talk a lot about the happy, healthy human being. That's the basic material of Dhamma life. And most of us have spent years and years, I've been ordained for nearly 40 years, and most of that's just getting happy and healthy. Forget about the insight bit of it. And just getting able to relate to other people in a sort of positive, kind of friendly way. So, yes, if you've not really worked on positive emotion, you're going to take this sort of thing in the wrong way and get upset, get depressed. And if you haven't really done work on spiritual receptivity or dhammic responsiveness, you haven't got a feeling for something that's sort of naturally flowing. And so your reflection on the Lakshanas will turn to nihilism. You may be emotionally positive, but you'll be a positive nihilist, because you haven't got a real sort of sense of something in you that's flowing naturally, coming from within you. And that, of course, leads to Nietzsche's Western Buddhism and to a lot of what is Western Buddhism today. We need to really work on these basics, which are not basics in a sense of nursery school. They're almost the whole thing. So that when we reflect, we're really behind it. Head and heart are there united. We're emotionally positive and, as it were, robust and alive. And we've got this strong sense of something moving that is sort of dammed up behind our construction of self and other. So we could just work a lot still on these basics. But we also need to be understanding clearly the Dhamma in the terms that I've already spoken of. We need to get a clear conceptual understanding. We need to apply it to our experience. We need to be reflecting on, for instance, old age, sickness, death. We need to be reflecting on the fact that we can't hold on to anything. And we need to be reflecting on the fact that it's karma that has made us, and karma that is our refuge for the future. These are the five ordinary reflections I mentioned the other day that the Buddha recommends for everybody. We need to pay attention to life. Moments when things go wrong, we need to read the lesson of that. Divorce practice, collapse, loss, failure, and so forth. Read the lesson. Rejection, unpopularity, criticism. Read the lesson of your own responses to these, because there is revealed this deeper self-attachment. And as you get more healthy, more positive, and more robust, and you begin to experience your spiritual force alive within you, well, you can investigate more and more closely what is actually going on, what's actually happening now. You can see that there is no fixed self, or you can ask, where is this self that seems to lie within every experience? Where is it? Where is the self in this sound that I'm hearing? Where is it? And in asking those questions, you can get to the point at which it's not there at all. So then these suprapersonal forces begin to flow completely spontaneously, unchecked, or at least uncheckable. They're still checked, but it's not possible to hold them back. Their flow is interrupted to some extent, but the flow continues. So this is what you're committing yourselves to doing in entering the order. You've asked to commit yourselves, to be recognized as committing yourselves to dying spiritually, to working to create the conditions through integration, positive emotion, spiritual receptivity, dharmic responsiveness, to create the conditions in which, under which, you can see through this self-clinging and let it go so that Dhamma-Niyama processes unfold. So make no mistake about this and recognize this is the whole meaning and purpose in the initial stages of what we're doing here. It's a key part of the meaning and purpose of what we're doing here. And just really make up your mind that this is what you want and that you're what you're willing to devote your life to, which means giving up a lot. Nothing particular, if you like, but it means shaping your life so that you can really die spiritually, so that these Dhamma-Niyama forces can flow. What those Dhamma-Niyama forces are like and how you encourage them yet further, we'll see tomorrow. Thank you.